I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Becky Malinsky was the deputy fashion director of the Wall Street Journal, now stylist and beloved Substack writer. As people began returning to work after the pandemic, she realized that no one knew how to get dressed, and she was the woman for the job. I fell in love with Becky's energy and conviction, and you will too. I'm talking to you from New York, but you're not from New York, are you?
No, I grew up in Minnesota. I've lived here 20 years.
How did y'all get to Minnesota?
Oh my God. My family has been in Minnesota for many generations on both sides, actually. My mother is from a farming family who all immigrated in like the late 1800s, I would like to say. And my father's family is from Russia, Romania, and they all came in like the 1910s, 20s. And honestly, I don't know how they settled in Minnesota.
I mean, I think what happens is you go where you have a cousin or something, right?
Totally. You go where you have a cousin.
Yeah, because yes. You have no money and you have you're like, well, we could stay in their house for like a month.
Right. And, you know, it's cold. It reminds them of home. Everyone. I mean, I am from pale stock all around. Yeah.
So how do you think Minnesota shaped who you've become or who you are?
Love Minnesota. I saw my son, who is four. He's, you know, he goes, are we going to go on spring break again next year? I go, yeah. Where do you want to go? He goes, I'd really like to go to Minnesota. And, you know, he just loves it there. He always, when are we moving to grandma's house? We can live.
Aww.
It's such a like near and dear part of me. I'm so proud to be from Minnesota. I think it's a place where, you know, Minnesota nice comes from something. people are generally warm and there's community. I felt very protected from the world in a way that is maybe good, maybe bad, but I felt like I had a real childhood. Like I rode my bike to school in fourth grade with my best friend. I went sledding every single day after school with my neighbors. And it was a freedom of childhood in a way that I don't think kids have that much anymore. And I don't know, you know, they probably don't have it that much anymore in Minnesota too. It felt like an amazing place to be free and just sort of be who you are without a lot of external pressure. And at least that was my experience. And I come from very hardworking stock. And I think that has helped me a lot along the way. And, you know, being a hard worker is part of my identity. And I don't know if that's part of being from Minnesota, that's how my grandma always was. That's how my mom is. It's something I'm proud of. And I think it really shapes my ability to see the world and to be able to just keep going.
How were you introduced to fashion in Minnesota?
I've always been very particular and opinionated about fashion and style. Even when I was a little kid, no one was allowed to dress me. I always had an opinion. My grandma, you know, because like every grandma thinks their child is like the most beautiful, perfect person.
Yeah.
You're going to be a model. We're going to make you a child model, but will you wear the dress that they tell you? And I was like, no, I'm not going to, you know, even at like 7 years old when my grandmother thought I was going to be a model. It was my mother who told me that I should maybe pursue something in fashion. So I sort of taught myself to sew in seventh grade. Grandmother, who is from, you know, Depression era, very Grapes of Wrath, but, you know, the northern Minnesota version, she had to sew all of their clothes. They used curtains. They made things work for years and years and years, even until she passed away, like reusing everything until it was disintegrated. And I wanted to learn to sew. And she just thought it was so ridiculous because she was like, you can buy something in the store now for cheaper than what would take your own personal labor to make it. And I started sewing and she told me I was doing it all wrong. And she told me the right way, here's going to be the right way how to do it. And so she taught me how to sew. And from that, and I was so interested in it, that my mom is the one who said, maybe you should think about doing something in fashion. Because for me, I was always going to be a doctor. My father was a doctor. My stepfather is a doctor. Everyone always told me you're going to be a doctor. I was very academic. Like I pursued my studies very rigorously from being very young up and through college. And it was my mom who said, you know what, actually, I think there's something here. Maybe you should look into it. And when I was in college, I came to New York.
For college?
Well, no, just in the summer, I had the University of Wisconsin. And weirdly, my roommates were from New York. And so they were going back home for the summer. They were like, you should come for the summer. And one of my roommates had an in who was a business major. She had an internship at Morgan Stanley. And she was like, I found a room in the NYU dorms. Like, come live in the NYU dorms for the summer. And so I said, oh yeah, sure. That sounds amazing. I literally had a my garage sale of my parents' basement. My mom said, if you have a garage sale, if you can sell all this stuff, you can take the money and go to New York. So I had a garage sale and I took all the money and I paid for the dorms in the summer to come to New York. I got an internship
I love it.
Cosmopolitan magazine. This was in 2002. From there, then the next summer I got another internship. And then when I moved back to New York, I just moved to New York. I had no job. I pounded the pavement. I would talk to anyone who would talk to me, like, oh, my friend's mom works in book publishing. Talk to her, you know. And I would just take a million meetings and
And from the first moment, was it the fashion part of it or was it the New York part of it? I mean, were you just.
that's a good question, actually, because it always felt like home from the day I got here. I always knew, like, even now, coming over the bridge, getting off the air, like coming from the airport, I'm like, oh, I'm home.
What made you feel that you could make a living doing that? Like that you had authority to even say other than you were opinionated.
Being young and stupid and just, you know, hard-headed. It was never, that's what I mean, like, you know, it's very youth is wasted on the young. Like, it was never thought in my mind that this was not going to be it. Like, it just had to work. I mean, now you think back and you think, oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. Could I imagine now just moving to a city and just knowing, like, I'm going to work really hard and get a job? And I was definitely stressed because I'm a high stress person for sure. But no, it was always just, this is what it is. And I'm going to get the job and I'm going to work so hard. You know, I had wanted a job in magazines. And this was like heyday of magazines, you know,
Yeah.
like,
Were you a journalism major?
so I was a journalism major. So I went to my first, you know, fashion major class because my mom was like, oh, pursue fashion. I had a panic attack. I was like, oh my God, I am majoring in sewing. What if sewing doesn't work out? Like, I can't, no. So I took a journalism 101 class. I fell in love. I had these internships at magazines. It felt like the synergy was there. I was like, oh, it introduced me to so many different paths and jobs that there were in fashion. Because in my head, coming from Minnesota, I was like, oh, if you want to work in fashion, you're going to be a fashion designer. You didn't even know that there were thousands of different types of jobs that you could have that are in that billion-dollar world.
Were you always a good writer? I mean, did that click automatically?
No, I definitely don't think I was always a great writer.
When you got to Cosmopolitan, that summer internship, and then you were going back for your senior year, did it make it clear that there were things that you needed to do better in order to come back and have a full job, a full-time job when you graduated?
I was so itchy and antsy to graduate and get out of there and start working that I would say I just sort of did what I had to do. It's the same thing as, you know, just coming to New York and knowing this is the only option. I remember I had to, because the journalism major at Wisconsin, it's like a 60,000 person campus. The journalism school only accepts 100 people per semester.
Whoa.
It's very competitive and nobody gets
Wow.
in the first time they apply. And I already had started late because I was coming from another major. So I had to apply two times. So I had to take one class the summer after graduation to finish, to like get the degree. And I came in and I was like, this is a strategy. You have to have sample trafficking and you have to do this. And I was like, I already know. And now thinking back, I'm like, oh my God, I didn't let anyone else have even one opinion. I was just like ready to go and ready to work.
Was your dad, your doctor dad, supportive of this path?
Very supportive of me, not very clear on what I was doing, but you know, loved me, trust me, knows that I am very responsible. There was not a lot of checking in on me. I think, you know, there's more checking in on my sister for sure. But just because I was so obsessed with like the competitiveness of work, you know, I was all like, I remember once my parents went on vacation, I had to stay at my aunt and uncle's, and my aunt kind of sleeps late. And I was going to be late to school. And I was just like, I have not had one tardy the entire year. You were getting out of bed to get me to school.
You graduated, you had your marketing class,
Yeah.
and you moved straight to New York. And did you go back to Cosmopolitan?
I did not. I didn't have a job. I knew I wanted to work in magazines. Just felt like this is it. This is the job. I couldn't get a job in magazines right away. So I got a job as the marketing assistant at the cashmere company Say, spelled
Yeah.
TSE. I don't
Yes, I know. Say,
still
yeah.
around
My
anymore.
wedding dress was Say.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, Narciso did a collection for them.
I remember.
But that was a cool company.
It was super cool. I mean, I only worked there a year, but we did so, like they were investing so heavily in the company when I was there. We did like the campaigns we shot were with the top models. They were with
Yeah.
Joe McKenna and Alastair
Yeah.
McLennan. And like, it was unbelievable what I was able to see at working at this cashmere brand for a year.
That's interesting. I bet that was really helpful.
Super helpful. Yeah. And I mean, I still knew I was like, I have to get in, I have to get it to a magazine. And I remember the assistant position came up, the market assistant position came up at Lucky Magazine. And I was like, I am going to get this job if this is the last thing I do.
How at that time did you know things like that?
I was the assistant in charge of all of the sample trafficking and all and the showroom. And my job would be to coordinate with the assistants at the magazines
Right,
and like
smart.
be in the showroom during like the press day when the editors would come by. And I'm sure I was so obnoxious and like, thinking like integrating myself a little too much, I would imagine. And I just made it my business to know everybody and get to know the assistants. And I would, do you want to get a drink after work to some of the assistants? So, I just sort of tried to develop a network in that way. And
Yeah.
one of the assistant at Lucky at the time, and Lucky at the time was like
Yeah,
the
everything.
place, like pre e-commerce. I got to know her because, like, she covered the knitwear market. Because back in the day, your whole job could be denim.
I know.
Yeah,
Hosiery.
yes, literally. Yeah, like I was talking about that with a friend the other day. I was like, remember when my entire job was covering denim and swimwear?
So crazy.
So crazy.
And so you got the
I
job.
got the job. When I tell you, I stayed up all night. I made a presentation of all the trends for the next season. I told them they could keep it if they needed to use it in their trend report.
Was that something that you had been thinking about with Say, or was it something
I
you?
just felt like I needed to bring something extra. I needed to be extra.
Was it right? I
It
mean,
was right. They
were
were
they?
obsessed. They were literally basically like, you're hired on the spot. They were like, can we keep this?
For the younger listeners, do you mind sharing what you think was so special about Lucky Magazine? I don't think, younger listeners won't know what that is.
Lucky Magazine changed the way magazines spoke to readers. They were the first fashion magazine that talked to you like you were their friend. And they would explain everything in really fun terms of different pairing of ways of pairing things. And this is before e-commerce. So you would get the magazine in the mail and it would come with a page of stickers that said yes on them. And you would tag all the things you liked and wanted to come back to. So it was basically a really well-edited like catalog by your best friend.
And the images were like almost like thumbnails, like the way that it almost
Yes.
was the internet before the internet, right? Like
The internet before the internet. We had
it kind
it was it in my heart, it is so heartbreaking to me that it is not the world's best e-commerce site.
was.
Like
Agreed.
it should have been the world's best e-commerce site, but the parent company just like didn't believe in the internet at the time, which it was new. So
Well, and speaking of, how do you think the fashion media landscape is going to continue to change over the next 10 years?
That's a great question. I wish I could answer that question. I do think, there'll be a few resources that survive. There will be a few publications that survive. It's going to be people being asked to do more with less, as has been the trajectory of the past 10 years. I think about this a lot in terms of people are always like, well, you could turn five things into a media brand. And I'm like, but I don't know. I don't really want to turn it into a
Right,
media
right.
brand. Have we learned nothing? So I do think like we're at a time right now where you're looking for trust in places where you feel like you have lost trust in sort of these bigger picture and bigger box companies. So I do think we're going to be looking for individuals that we can trust. I think a lot about this in terms of Glamour because I left Glamour before it was turned into only a website. But like the big problem with Glamour then is that you can't be everything to everyone. And I think we're going to see things that are niche surviving because
Yeah.
when you try to be everything to anyone, you set yourself up for failure because that's too much.
Yeah.
And no one can be that. So And that I think was always a struggle for Glamour. It's like, how do you include everyone?
And so literally straight to Lucky. And what was that like? And what was your job there?
I was the assistant to the market director, and her markets were, she covered European markets and American designer.
Great.
And so, you know, I met all of those assistants, and, you know, those are people now running marketing departments for some of these luxury houses that I'm still working with. And so some people, we've been working together 20 years at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just like kind of kept working. And then I worked at Lucky in 2008 when McKinsey came in to like reorg the company. Basically, all assistants were let go. The only brand that was allowed to keep their assistants was GQ. And because I was like a star assistant at the company, I got transferred to GQ and I became the assistant.
Well, that must have been completely different, was it? I mean, from the start, completely different? Yeah.
I loved it though.
Yeah.
I mean, it was definitely the hardest. Physically hardest job I ever had, because we were, you know, it was the days of like traveling with 30 trunks and, you know, and I remember once I was literally steaming a suit in a cornfield in like Louisiana, and like on the phone with one of the other editor to book the travel for the next shoot. And like, I was like, oh my God, what is my life? What?
But also like, isn't this the best life?
I mean, life. It was so amazing.
What is my life? And thank God, that's so cool.
Yeah.
So the styling part came with it. I mean, and did that, was that a natural fit for you automatically?
Natural fit. This is what I felt like. This is the job. This is what I love this. I love putting things together. I'm so opinionated. I love finding things like the mix of it all. That was it to me. I thought I'm going to be a stylist. That's what this is. I never had second thought in my head that writing was going to be a part of what I did. I was still always really into newspapers because of my training. You know, in college, we had to subscribe to 3 newspapers. I still, you know, was getting a print newspaper. Was still something that was really important to me. It was at the time when they were building out Tea and Sun. I loved Sunday Styles and WSJ. WSJ is a bit later forming, but Tea was so important to me. So I was always like, I love this, but if a job ever came up in a newspaper, oh my God.
And so it did. Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
And were you doing the same thing when you got there?
It was a very small team at Off Duty. So it was the weekend supplement. And they had one editor who was in charge of all of the copy, of assigning the writers, of getting it fit into the section. And then my job was all of the market, all of the shoots, all of the creative ideas to make the shoots. So the production, I sort of did all the visual components because it was sort of a tag team. Because it's such a small team, you had a lot of opportunity to do other things if you wanted to. So I started writing small things and then would get the opportunity to write bigger things. And the job was busy enough as it was. There wasn't a ton of time to write. But when you're at a newspaper, the focus is great stories.
And did it happen quickly?
Yeah, pretty quickly. I had a really amazing relationship with the woman who hired me, who was the fashion director at the time. We were very close.
Who was that?
Meenal Mistry.
Oh, I love Meenal.
We're still very close. She's so awesome. She's so smart. She made me a better writer. The editor of the section, too, was an unbelievable editor and writer. And so I feel extremely lucky and grateful that they were the two who were my work. So that's, I think, what made me a good writer is the two of them.
But was that sort of the time when you started to think about like what really is important for people? Like, how does fashion really relate to people's lives?
I think that is the ethos of Off Duty. So ever since I started there in 2015, the question was always why. So I remember my first meeting with my editor, who is not a fashion person. He's a newspaper person. And I was like, okay, we're going to do this story on sheer. And sheer is the trend for falls, when Prada did all of those sheer overlays with the paillettes. And he was like, okay, but why? And like, how are women supposed to be wearing this? And when was the last time sheer was popular? And how is it different now than it was then? And like, and I was like,
all good questions.
I was like, and I will get back to that. I was like, give me 20 minutes. And that was the first time anyone had, because I had only ever worked at fashion magazines. Cause so I came from Glamour. We didn't talk about that, but I had worked at Glamour for many years after GQ. And
doing the same thing?
Doing the same thing. I was the market editor. I was the editor for American and British markets.
Wow.
I had always been at a place where fashion was the point of the job, like was full point. It was why you were picking up the magazine. It was why we were here doing the job. And then I moved into a place where fashion is a very small part, but something people are interested in. And a small, very small part of the company. and not the main part of the company. I didn't intuit that right away.
How long did it take to get that? Yeah.
It took a while. And
that's interesting.
It was the first time someone ever questioned why sheer? Why polka dots? You know,
what does it even mean?
And I had to be able to answer that. And you had to be able to explain why that mattered or why should I care? Why should people care? And that was such a mind shift for me. And that is actually what made me the writer I am today, is because I'm now able to start with that for every story. Why do people care? Like, why should they care? People are so busy. You know, I was at the doctor with my kid all morning. Now I have a client fitting this afternoon. Why should people care enough to stop and read what I'm going to write?
You were already writing sort of with that mindset at Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
On Substack, I mean, you're such a beautiful writer, and it's such a completely different voice, I guess. I mean, speaking in the first person is just totally. So completely different than anything you've done in your career, other than we like this. We think this is, you know, what people should be wearing. How did you shift into that?
I always like to say I'm doing the same thing on a different platform, because it does feel like that. It is a bit more personal in that it is just me at the end of the day. There's not layers of opinions and approvals, and that can be good and bad, you know, not having someone to bounce things off of. I actually try to be careful not to do too much first person, and I make sure that I bring the reader in and bring in anecdotes that maybe aren't me as well. I do think people relate more to the casualness of the first person and, you know, the similarities in being a working parent and, you know, having a lot on your plate. So I do think that is important, but I also try to keep it balanced, because I definitely get first person fatigue reading from other people, and I don't want people to have that from me too. And I think not writing in the first person actually is a dying skill.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, because what are the platforms for it, really?
Yeah, exactly. There's very few. And towards the end of my time at Wall Street Journal, it was getting harder and harder for us to find people who can write long form stories that are reported out, because the need to push out content on these sites is like much shorter. I was not even the editor, and the like editor focused on writing, and it would be my job to work with the writers to be like, here are our suggestions of people you should interview, and maybe here are some questions. And, you know, people, it's really a dying skill, sadly, because there's no outlet for it.
It's such a big part of my day, weirdly. I'm such a reader, I always have been. But I was thinking today, like, I read tons and tons of magazines before, and books, and obviously, but I mean, other than blogs, I guess, like, is there anything comparable to this?
I don't know if right now there is anything comparable. I think we're at like a really interesting crossroads of what the future of, I guess, media is and what media means. And which is a bit strange, because I think a lot of the long form stuff is paid for and done by brands. Like, you see Dior has big, beautiful magazine coming out, you know, quarterly, and Loewe does these photo journals. And so it's very interesting, you know, but that's all, of course, funded by a brand. And you just see these big, big media entities just struggling to have the resources to do the quality work that they need to do. So it's tricky. And I definitely don't know the answer.
Somebody said, like, what is the one thing that you really need to know about sustainability? And she said, it was Vanessa Barboni from Another Tomorrow. And she said, you need to know that everything that you consume, everything that you wear, buy, eat, you know, listen to, read, the person who created it is earning a living wage. And I'm such a proud payer on Substack, you know, and I'm really like, and I really decide, like, I'm actually not going to pay that person. I don't really like his writing that much, but I love these 10 or 15, you know, I mean, it's just interesting.
That's so fascinating. Yeah. I think a lot about this in terms of, I feel very grateful to my time at the Journal, because we, for many reasons, but we had very, very strict ethics policies, and we had to have training in it twice a year. Like, it wasn't like you take this course when you start and then you know how we do stuff here. It was, here's a refresher course. Here are different ways that people can try to infiltrate that. Here are Here are different scenarios and ways for you to combat it. And I actually worked in this framework during the rise of social media, during the rise of influencers, during a huge shift in fashion media, in like, now like LVMH can pay for a cover look. To be protected from that and to see that feels so important to who I am and what my newsletter is, and the idea that the reader is smart and no one wants to feel duped, and
Yeah.
that's so important to me. And I don't, and not everyone has that training, and we're now losing the resources to give people that training. And that's something that's scary for me.
Did you start to moonlight doing this, or
Oh, no.
are you allowed to do that? I don't even.
No, you're not. I mean, again, they had really strict ethics policies. You couldn't contribute anywhere else. And when people wanted to write a book, it had to go through a whole approval process. It's really interesting. I remember, like, when brands were starting to have their own blogs and newsletters, they would ask if I would be on it. That was never approved. Could never participate in any sort of brand media, anything like that. I actually left for a completely different reason. I left in the summer of 2022 as the world was really starting to open up. And as COVID restrictions were ending, I was listening to a lot of podcasts at the time. I was going back to the office. I was spending a lot of time on the subway. And I was just in a real podcast mindset. Still love them, but I don't commute anymore.
Yeah, right.
So it's not like it's as big of a part of my day.
Yeah.
Every single podcast I listened to was talking about the new norms of office dressing and that nobody knows how to get dressed. And everyone has these full closets and they're looking up, they don't know what to wear. And I mean, this was on like news podcasts. I remember explicitly a conversation they were having on the Harvard Women at Work podcast. I was like, oh my God, light bulb moment. This is a business. I'm going to help people get dressed for work. And I'm going to launch this styling business, and I'm not going to do weddings, and I'm not going to do bar mitzvahs, and I'm only going to help women. Well, and I have some male clients. I'm only going to help people figure out their work uniform so that they don't have to spend time on this in the morning and that they can feel great. And everybody is public facing in this weird way now because they're on Zoom and they're on panels, and everyone wants video. And it just came over me. I was like, this is it. This is the business.
And I think the other part about it was that I think the world expected, and especially fashion or designers, expected people to just come back and wear that same closet exactly what they had worn before. And you're just like, you're not really wearing that again, are you? Like, because it's like acting like you didn't go through the last 2 years, like it
Totally.
didn't happen.
And people got nervous of being too overdressed. And, but then they were, and you remember like every article was about sweatpants and how are people going to give up their sweatpants? And then it was all sparkly crop tops and like things were going so wild and so
Bananas.
extreme. And it was so
It
crazy. And I don't know why. I just knew. I was like, this is the business. I'm quitting my job. And if I start this business, it has to be right now. The moment is hot. And I quit my job and I didn't even tell my mom. I remember talking on the phone with my mom. I was like, oh yeah, and I quit my job and blah, blah, blah. It's like, what? And I think I thought about it for maybe a week or two before I did it because I was like, I love my job. I could do this job for the rest of my life, but like, I'm too young to die with newspapers. And, so there was a little bit of that of like, what is the future beyond media? I'm not going to pretend that I didn't think about that at all. But I think that merge with like, this is the time to do this work. And I'm really good at this type of, I was like, this is what I do best. Like, I'm the oldest living market editor at this point. And I know what's out there. And like, this is it.
Did your colleagues think you were crazy?
Yes, a lot thought I was crazy. And a lot of friends, I had a very secure job. Like, everyone's like, your job of like all these jobs at Z Magazine is like the most secure job. Like, what are you doing? And I just like knew it in my heart of hearts. I don't know how. I just knew it, and
Yeah.
I left. I wasn't even gonna say anything, and all my friends who worked in PR, they were like, no, you're gonna like have a portrait taken and you're gonna put it on Instagram and you're gonna say I'm launching this business. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's what I'm gonna do.
And so when you launched it, did it launch with Substack?
I launched it at the same time just because I wanted to have something for me and then something for all of these other people. But the reason I left my job was to launch this professional styling business, which is still a huge business for me. So I'm now, but with the newsletter, I'm basically running two businesses.
Does writing the Substack, obviously it feeds the styling business. I mean, I'm sure people say like, oh my God, I love what you did last week. And
you would be surprised, actually. I think most of my clients are clients before, and then they find out I have a newsletter and they're like, I want to be on that. Now there are a few more coming from the newsletter, but I would say the majority of my clients were not newsletter readers first. It's a very word of mouth business. So I was working with two different executives at a commercial real estate company. And, you know, then they have someone has a friend or the company has someone else they want me to work on. And you sort of infiltrate groups of friends almost. I work with a few different groups of friends.
Well, I was going to ask that. So when you started though, were you totally sure that you had, I mean, I know you knew all the market editors, but were you sure Yes. that you had enough contacts to do this?
No, I was not at all. And I was like, I have no idea how I'm going to get clients. Well, I'll start the newsletter and then, you know, something will work out, you know, and it's going to be slow at first. And, you know, I had a long talk with my husband and I was like, it's going to be, you know, my goal is to make like this much this month. And
yeah, right.
And he was very supportive, thankfully. It actually took off so insanely fast because I think it was a service that once people realized existed, they wanted it. It was just about feeling better and working faster in your personal style and people recognizing that that's such an important part of work and their work identities now.
I don't think we ever really heard that from media, from magazines, especially. Like it would be like, look like a boss and like, you know, a full Prada, you know, head to toe. You know, you're like, really?
And then look like a boss and wear a pencil skirt.
Yeah, you're just like, what?
I've always been a people like it's always been the people first. And Wall Street Journal kind of helped me hone that in that, like, knowing what you're good at. And, you know, like I am good at figuring out how to translate real fashion for real people. And like, I'm never going to be the stylist, like shooting Comme des Garçons, rolling around on the beach. And it's like the most beautiful avant-garde shoot you've ever seen. And it's going to go in the British Museum, you know? And, you know, maybe there was a time when I was like, oh, I'm never going to be the fashion director of W Magazine, you know? And like, that was heartbreaking to me. And, but being able to sort of take a step back and recognize what you're good at. And like, I was like, the service is what I'm good at. Like, this is what helping people and translating this and making it work is what I am actually able to contribute. And that was very eye-opening for me, sort of quitting my job, figuring this all out. Like, okay, no, this is what I do.
It's interesting because I think it was just like that whole era of magazines was not about serving people. It didn't feel like, I mean, I say that from being almost 30 years a store in North Carolina. And it was always really frustrating to me because I was actually selling clothes and I would, you know, you would read magazines and you would be like, okay, that's not actually really a real thing. You know,
I remember my first client and I was hired by this company and they were promoting someone and they gave her a budget to hire someone to help because, you know, she's going to have to be really public facing. And I thought it was going to be so easy. I was like, oh yeah, I know everything out there. This is going to be so easy. But finding the thing that is, you know, you're 40, great body. You don't want to look old. You're not going to wear ruffles. That middle ground of like looking professional, looking in charge, but looking like you have a point of view is it has made me look at fashion in such a different way and interact with designers in such a different way of like, real people are going to have to wear this right. And buy this. So like, where are the tops?
Yes.
Like, where are the tops?
Right. Your writing is so inspiring. All the girls in the store who work with me, they all follow it and we all talk about it. I mean, it's really inspiring for them to be able to talk to their clients as well. And to say like, just put a sock with it, you know, like, you know, and the person's like, really, can you do that? And you're like, yeah, Becky. I mean, oh, it's such a thing. I mean, it really is so helpful. And it's almost like what I always wished magazines had been, you know, that to give us license to be able to like be human and do, I mean, look amazing, but also like be realistic at the same time.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad to hear that.
What's your biggest challenge right now?
It's just a lot. I mean, it's a lot to manage. You know, I'm managing basically two different companies because the Substack is a business now. And managing my other business, which is very personal. You know, I work with people. People are always like, well, are you going to hire someone? I'm like, but people aren't hiring me to have someone else's opinion on what they should wear. So, you know, it's sort of learning how to run your own business and delegate in a way that I haven't quite figured out yet. And then being a present parent, like what we're all dealing with is, being able to be there for our kids when you have to get back on every night after bedtime because you are the business.
What did you wear to prom?
I think it was Nicole Miller.
Nice.
I'm going to give you two answers, actually, because I wore a dress to prom and then to my winter formal, which I think was revolutionary.
Okay.
So to prom, I wore a Nicole Miller, or was it a Betsy Johnson? I can't remember. But it was a strapless, floor-length column gown, and it was black. It was like thick stripes, so black on the top, and then white, and then black, and then white,
How
and then from
gorgeous.
below hip down, it was black. And then between on each seam was little mini seed bead floral embroidery.
Ooh.
Thought it was amazing.
It is amazing.
And then, but to winter formal, I wore ABS Allen Schwartz. It was lace on the top, black lace with nude under, and then it had like a cummerbund. And then it had from the low waist, like a poof out circle skirt to the knee, black satin, like a Duchess satin. And this was a time that you did not wear anything other than floor length to a formal. The
Nice.
people were, can you see her? Like I could see them talking, whispering, but I felt like I didn't care. I was like, I'm the best dressed here. And they're just whispering because they're jealous. And like, I was so confident in this dress. I still think it's one of the most beautiful things. But I just like remember it being so outrageous.
I love it. And jewelry or shoes, you remember that, or hair, anything?
I didn't wear any jewelry, I don't think, with the winter formal to prom. I wore this little, it was almost like a Victorian. It has like a fuchsia floral, like with a patina, like little choker.
Those are really good. We've heard some doozies, but those are both very beautiful, and it sounds like you actually would wear them now.
Yeah, I wonder if I'd fit.
Thank you, Becky, so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.